Welcome back again to BadQuaker.com podcast. Today is podcast number 99 for Thursday, February 9th, 2012. And as you can already hear, my co-host today is Baggy the Cat, and I'm Ben Stone. Kai's not with me today, but I'm sure Baggy is going to do everything she can to try to fill in the missing spaces there. Oh no, she's turned her tail up and she's left now. Okay, so today is podcast 99. What I have for you today, first off, I should explain who these people are. There's an organization called TED, or TED Talks, and the TED stands for, it's TED, all capital letters, TED Talks. The TED, the TED in the TED Talks stands for Technology, Entertainment, and Design. Now, the TED is essentially, I believe it's a yearly get together in places like Long Beach or Palm Springs, or they have other locations as well. The one I'm going to be talking about was in the Netherlands, if I recall. Oh yeah, it was in the Netherlands. Anyway, TED is sort of a get together of super, super rich people and really smart people and really important people, and, you know, important people like actors and Al Gore and people like that. But it's also people like Bill Gates goes there, and, back in the day, Steve Jobs went to a few of them. And it's a lot of people who are important or self-important or smart, or they believe they're smart, or they're super rich and they're trying to look impressive. And so some of these TED Talks are really, really good. Some of them... you just scratch your head. Now, a friend of mine sent me one that was, it's only about 17 minutes long, if I recall. I think it's 17 minutes long, but it's very impressive and it's very moving. And if you just listen to it on the surface, you might pick out a couple things like, ooh, well, that's a little odd. But if you really analyze it, there's some really scary aspects to this particular TED talk. Now, I'm going to attempt to say the guy's name, but before I do, let me make a quote. I want to quote Hans Seinholz. He said, "War cannot be driven out by war, for the use of evil breeds more evil, hostility more hostility, and the use of force more force." Now, I just want to read that for you one more time. Hans Seinholz. "War cannot be driven out by war, for the use of evil breeds more evil, hostility more hostility, and the use of force more force." Now, some of us might put it simpler and say, two wrongs can't make a right. You can't produce good by doing evil. It's along the same concept. But however you want to word it, I think the concept is pretty well established as being essentially a principle that it's hard to try to find a logical way around it. Okay, now this TED talk that I was referring to, this gentleman, I'm going to have even a harder time pronouncing his name than I had with Hans Seinholz. His name is, and I apologize, this is the best I can do, I'm not accustomed to Dutch names, but his name is something to the effect of Peter Van Om, and he, what I'll do here is I have the transcript written out of the talk, and you can find the link directly to the TED talk starring this Peter Van Om. Right there at badquaker.com on the page where this podcast appears, you can just click on the link and listen to it. Like I said, it's a 17-minute video, and it's really worth watching because the guy is, He's real good at delivery, and it's well worth watching. But also, you might be able to see some of my points if you actually watch him give the presentation. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to read each section and then give a critique of each section as we go through. So this is a word-for-word reading of his presentation. Okay, and I'm beginning the quote. When I look around, I see people who want to make a contribution. I see people who want to make a better world by doing groundbreaking scientific work, by creating impressive works of art, by writing critical articles or inspiring books, by starting up sustainable businesses. And you all have chosen your own instruments to fulfill this mission of creating a better world. Some chose the microscope as their instrument. Others chose dancing or painting or making music, just like we just heard. Some choose the pen. Others work through the instrument of money. And now I'm going to end the quote there. As he's speaking these words, a soldier, now he's in full uniform, and a soldier comes walking out onto the stage carrying a rifle. You can immediately notice the insecurity of the crowd, because this is mostly, these TED Talks kind of appeal to the left. So most of these people are, left-leaning types. So as the soldier comes out, she is carrying this rifle, and both she and Peter Van Olm, they do the ritual verifying that the weapon is not loaded. They go through all the proper steps. She hands him the rifle. He takes it. She steps to the side. And now I'm going to go back to the quote again. "Ladies and gentlemen, I made a different choice." And then he says, "Thanks, ladies and gentlemen," because there's uncomfortable laughter and kind of sporadic applause. I mean, you could really tell these people don't know how to handle just the idea of a soldier standing there with a modern rifle in his hands. Some of these people are so unbelievably... I'll just be polite. Anyway, they are clearly not comfortable with having a uniformed soldier holding a modern rifle on stage. So let's get back to the quote. He says, "I share your goals. I share the goals of the speakers you heard before. I did not choose to take up the pen, the brush, the camera. I choose this instrument, the gun. For you, and you heard already, being so close to this gun may make you feel uneasy. It may even feel scary. A real gun at a few feet's distance. Let us stop for a moment and feel this uneasiness. You could even hear it. Let us cherish the fact that probably most of you have never been so close to a gun. It means the Netherlands is a peaceful country. The Netherlands is not at war. It means soldiers are not needed to patrol our streets. Guns are not a part of our lives. In many countries, it is a different story. In many countries, people are confronted with guns. They are oppressed. They are intimidated by warlords, by terrorists, by criminals. Weapons can do a lot of harm. They are the cause of much distress. Why, then, am I standing before you with this weapon? Why did I choose the gun as my instrument? Today, I want to tell you why. Today, I want to tell you why I chose the gun to create a better world, and I want to tell you how this gun can help." End of that quote. Now, like I said, I'll go through each little section of this and give a critique of it. So now, considering what I just read, the next part I'm not going to read, because I'll just give you a kind of an overview. He then goes on to tell the story of his father, who fought the Nazis. The point of his story seems to be that the Dutch failed to repel the invading Nazis because they had an ill-equipped military, and because they trusted in diplomacy. So they had to wait around for the glorious American liberators to save them. This, he says, is why he chose the gun as his instrument to make a better world. The problem is, this is a bizarre fantasy handed out by the state as a substitute to the reality of the horrors of the Second World War and the failures of the governments to fulfill their promises in light of the First World War. And this fantasy was happily adopted by people who, through their blind faith in their governments, refused to face the fact that should have been obvious in their day. That being, both World War I and World War II were the result of inept and even evil governments, drunk on the power of state aggression combined with a willing and bloodthirsty mainstream media. The Nazis didn't magically appear out of nowhere. The Nazis were a duly elected government. And as night follows day, World War II was directly the result of the botched ending of World War I and the actions taken as a result of the Treaty of Versailles that ended that war. There was actually only one world war, divided by a pause of 20 years. And now I'm going to get nitpicky on this guy's little speech here. He says, and I'm quoting here, "The Netherlands is a peaceful country. The Netherlands is not at war." And then he tells about, as the speech continues, he tells about his combat experiences in Lebanon, Sarajevo, and Afghanistan. Now, this is a typical neocon wordsmithing. This is statist doublespeak at its best. We're both not at war, and we are engaged in a war on terrorism, so we must invade some small, poor, weak country and inflict our will on it and our form of socialism. This is the position of the defeated Winston Smith in 1984, where he admits 2 plus 2 equals 5. You are knowingly making a self-contradictory statement and insisting to yourself that it's true. Now, I'm going to go back to the quote again. He says, "And this is why I took up the gun, not to shoot, not to kill, not to destroy, but to stop those who would do evil, to protect the vulnerable, to defend democratic values, to stand up for the freedom we have, to talk here today in Amsterdam about how we can make the world a better place." Now, at this point, I want to point out something. And you can read, if you follow the link and you go over there and you watch the video, I'm fairly confident you'll see what I feel about this too. I believe that the guy is absolutely sincere. I believe he is absolutely sincere. I believe that as sincere as he is equally deluded. His good intentions and his mind are twisted by the propaganda of the state that he's been fed over the years. Starting as a very young child, given the excuses from his father and the justification that his father made and all the lies that were fed to him, growing up in state schools and all the propaganda that was fed to him throughout the years as he grew up. And then once he went into, you know, higher levels of school and of education or went into the military or whatever, he adopted this mythology slowly. And I believe he thoroughly believes it. And I believe he is entirely sincere. And I believe it is his deepest desire to create a better world. I believe that. However, he is delusional, because remember the quote that I said earlier, "War cannot be driven out by war, for the use of evil breeds more evil, hostility, more hostility, and the use of force, more force." Now, that doesn't at all exclude self-defense. Once again, just like the zero aggression principle, self-defense is perfectly acceptable. But now let's get back to our thing here. Where I just quoted, now he makes this statement about the, he wants to defend democratic values. Now, I'm not even going to touch the myth of democratic values. I think probably if you're listening to this podcast, you probably know my opinion of all things democracy. But what I do want to point out is his setup in this sentence of his justification of faith in the state. He doesn't smack you right with it right away. He hands it to you a little at a time. He uses the distraction and the drama of holding the rifle the same way a stage magician uses a scantily clad assistant. It's just part of the smoke and mirrors. It's to distract you so that your mind is going in another direction and you can accept his words without really thinking about the depth of what he's saying. This is a really old magician's trick or a hypnotize yeah, well, you know what I mean. Anyway, let's keep going, or else I'm going to run out of time here before I even get into it. Good. Okay, I'm going to further quote him. So he says, "Ladies and gentlemen, I do not stand here today to tell you about the glory of weapons. I do not like guns. And once you have been under fire yourself, it brings home even more clearly that a gun is not some macho instrument to brag about. I stand here today to tell you about the use of the gun as an instrument of peace and stability. The gun may be one of the most important instruments of peace and stability that we have in this world." Now, let me just point out something. You can't sell a lie without including some elements of truth. And there are some elements in truth in what he just said. He said the gun may be one of the most important instruments of peace and stability that we have in this world. And that's only half true unless you add the fact that when only one group is allowed to possess the guns, tyranny is the guaranteed result. You see, he's in Amsterdam, and in most of Europe, including Amsterdam, the gun laws are pretty restrictive. So the world that he's talking about and the audience he's talking to, this is a situation that he's painting here where one group of people has the guns and only one group of people, and he happens to be that one group of people, or he happens to be a member of that one group of people. Now, I did want to mention while we're on this section that the part of what he's saying is true is that a gun or any particular weapon, really, is or can be an instrument of peace if it is a deterrent, if it is used in a defensive way. That makes it a deterrent to aggression, and it can be a very effective tool for peace. But once you cross that line and use any weapon for aggressive purposes, you defeat the whole reason of the weapon being useful towards peace, because you're using it in an aggressive manner. Again, two wrongs don't make a right. More evil does not create good. And the solution to not being able to create good with evil, you can't just pour more evil on it and expect good to eventually develop. Okay, let's get back to his quote now. He says, "Now this may sound contradictory to you, but not only have I seen this with my own eyes during my deployments in Lebanon and Sarajevo and internationally as the Netherlands' chief of defense, this is also supported by cold, hard statistics. Violence has declined dramatically over the last 500 years. Despite the pictures we are shown daily in the news, wars between developed countries are no longer commonplace. The murder rate in Europe has dropped by a factor of 30 since the Middle Ages, and occurrences of civil war and repression have declined since the end of the Cold War. Statistics show that we are living in a relatively peaceful area." Now, end quote. Now, at this point in time, I'm reminded of the wise words of the songwriter Todd Snyder in his song Statistician Blues, where he says something like, 64% of all the world's statistics are made up right there on the spot, and 82.4% of people believe them, whether those are accurate statistics or not. You see, how could anyone accurately track crime statistics from the Middle Ages? These same state apologists who want us to believe that the Middle Ages were a time of wild barbarism where people, where the poor and the lower classes behaved like savages, they also want us to believe that armies of statisticians and record keepers roamed the underbelly of European cities, making notes every time a body slipped into the Thames at 3 a.m. They used church and court records to invent their data, but they have no way of tracking the violence of the masses that were outside of the proper church and court reach. Those people that were down there in the sewers where the real crime happens, there's no way of knowing all that information. It's not recorded anywhere. There were no people roaming around down in the poorest sections of the European cities taking notes of murders and robberies and so forth. It just wasn't done. But the bigger lie is in ignoring the real source of violence and murder. Now, keep this in mind. 500 years ago, in the time frame that he's talking about during the Middle Ages, 500 years ago, the only true states in Europe were England, France, and Spain. Now, Russia was on the edge, and the Ottoman Empire was on one edge, and there was the Holy Roman Empire. But as Voltaire tells us, the Holy Roman Empire was neither holy, Roman, nor an empire. It was simply a loose confederacy of Germanic proto-states. It was not really an organized state at all. So really, you in Europe proper, you just had the states of England, France, and Spain. And 500 years ago, Spain was teetering. It had just finished a revolution, and it was not all that stable. They had just finished kicking the Moors out, and Spanish rule had just been returned to the Christian powers, and it was very unstable. But the vast bulk of Eastern Europe was completely stateless. Now, there were little lords, and there were little dukes, and there were little tyrants maybe here and there scattered around. But the bulk of Eastern Europe, the bulk of everything through all the Germanic languages and through most of that whole area of Eastern Europe was stateless. Now, when he talks about crime statistics and murder rates and so forth like that, just keep in mind, think for yourself what war would have been like 500 years ago. Now, let's just think for a second what the weaponry was like. The best firearms of the day were smoothbore flintlock guns. Very inaccurate, very unreliable, I think they may have had matchlocks at that time, too, matchlocks and flintlocks, but very unreliable, very not a good one shot and it turns into a club. The most effective weapons would have been in the long-handled battle axes and lances and swords. So a battle would last a day, and there would be perhaps three or four or five battles a year over the course of a war. Now, that would be a big war. Now, when you would have a battle, let's say you had 500 soldiers on each side that clashed into each other in a battle. The actual death rate in a battle like that was not all that high. You would have a lot of people horribly maimed, and some would die later of infection. But the actual death rate on the battlefield was not that high. Now, let's just compare that with war in the 20th century. We opened the 20th century with World War I, where the brand new invention of smokeless gunpowder allowed a tremendous advance in the ability to blow things up, the tremendous advance in the ability to send much larger projectiles much further distances than ever before. So the First World War was marked by huge sections of the countryside just pulverized by artillery, machine guns cutting down massive frontal charges that were leftovers from Napoleonic types of war. And so it was just barbarism that was unimagined prior to that at any point in time in history. The state never had the ability to kill its own soldiers with that kind of efficiency. Then in addition to that, we had for the first time chemical warfare, gases, mustard gas, and other kinds of gases that would kill or maim the soldiers at real high rates. So this is what we had coming into the 20th century, and that was in World War I. Now, World War II got even worse. The planes became unbelievably efficient. The bombing became just amazingly powerful. Entire cities could now be leveled in a campaign of bombing from the sky. And the World War II finished with the dropping of two atomic bombs on two Japanese cities, incinerating almost the entire population of those two cities. Now, this type of behavior, that type of warfare never took place in the Middle Ages. In 500 years ago, in the Middle Ages, war was between warriors. It was not waged upon civilian populations. There were always civilian casualties. There were always some civilian civilians that got caught up in the process, and there were farms that would get looted, and things like this would happen. But no time prior to the 20th century did we see entire cities of civilians wiped out by the state aggression like this. Now, when you compare the Middle Ages and you realize that war was on a individual personal level, where a warrior looked at another warrior in the eye as they fought things out, and so the death levels were very low. We don't really know what murder rate was really like. We can lie about it, or we can make up statistics, or we can, you know, read church records and project that out into the public, but none of that is really going to be accurate. What we do know is in the 20th century, the state stepped up and murdered to a level that had never happened in human history before. And that's not only in war. If you go outside of proper war and you think of how many people were killed in the exterminations in the Ukraine by the Soviets, and you think of how many people in a non-war setting where Hitler killed his own people through mass murder, not through actual war, but through the mass murder that he did with concentration camps. And then you think about the quantity of people that Mao Zedong killed, and the quantity of people that were killed in Cambodia in the killing fields. And you think about the slaughter like this that's been happening in Africa almost nonstop in these small third world countries for the last, I don't know, 20, 30 years. Now that's what's going on with the state in the 20th century. And you think, well, but crime is down. Well, maybe it is. I don't know, because the statistics don't exist. Reliable statistics don't exist for the Middle Ages. But let's assume that's true. Let's assume crime really is less now than it was in the Middle Ages. Let's just assume that this heavy hand of the state does prevent some crime. But how does that compare to the massive quantities that the state itself has slaughtered in bringing that hand down upon us? There is no comparison. There's no mass murder that ever lived. I think it was in yesterday's podcast. I can't remember for sure now. Recently, I was talking to Kai, and there was a comparison of Charles Manson to Richard Nixon. Yeah, Charles Manson told his followers to kill people, and maybe as much as 15 or 20 people got killed because of that. But Nixon lied to the American people on several occasions. Nixon sent out bombing raids into a country that we were not at war with, in Laos, and lied to the American people about it. Nixon killed far more people than in Charles Manson's entire life. If you added all the people Charles Manson has ever known in his whole life, Nixon killed more people through his words than Manson ever met or knew. And yet, the state gets a pass on its behavior. Charles Manson is spending the rest of his life in jail, and your tax dollars, if you're in the United States, your tax dollars are paying to keep him healthy and happy and comfortable in his jail cell. All right, I'm going to have to move on, otherwise I'm not going to get through this guy's entire speech. Okay, now let's look back real quick at something I just read of this guy's. He says, "And occurrences of civil war and repression have declined since the end of the Cold War." Well, the Cold War didn't end that long ago, so that's not really a very good test. That's kind of a that's kind of a slanted test to put that kind of restrictions on your statement. However, since the end of the Cold War, there was, in Europe, there was pretty much nonstop war on local scales as the struggles took place to try to straighten out what was going on after the Soviet Union collapsed. And NATO was involved in that, by the way. And then throughout from, 2001 till the present, we've had 10 straight years of NATO involvement in war in Afghanistan and almost endless NATO engagements in other places. Now, in addition to that, if you think about it, this thing that he recorded was done in November of 2011. And this TED Talk was done in November of 2011. And that's right in the shadow of the revolutions and unrest and repressions that swept North Africa and throughout all the Middle East the whole year of 2011 and are still going on now in 2012. What about all that? Where exactly is this peace that you're talking about, Peter? Okay, let's get back to quoting him again. Why? Why has violence decreased? Has the human mind changed? Well, we were talking on the human mind this morning. Did we simply lose our beastly impulses for revenge, for violent rituals, for pure rage? Or is there something else? In his latest book, Harvard professor Steven Pinker, and many other thinkers before him, concludes that one of the main drivers behind less violent societies is the spread of the constitutional state and the introduction on a large scale of the state monopoly on the legitimized use of violence, legitimized by the democratically elected government, legitimized by checks and balances, and an independent judicial system. In other words, a state monopoly that has the use of violence well under control. End quote. Now, to start with, let's set aside the Hobbesian nonsense, okay? This crazy, silly idea that humans, given the opportunity, without the state right there to control them, humans would just fall on each other and murder. It would be war of all against all, and everybody would just be savages. This is entirely ridiculous. But let's just set that aside for a second. Let's set aside this Hobbes, this court gesture with all his fallacies. The real nature of human beings and animals has nothing at all to do with that Hobbesian nonsense. If you look at humans and you realize we are simply animals, we are mammals. Now, those who are of a religious tilt, you probably think something along the lines of that man was made in the image of God. Whether man is considered simply another mammal or whether man is considered made in the image of God, it is entirely illogical to make this assumption that given the opportunity, man will just fall on himself savagely and devour one another with all abandon. No other animal behaves that way, and that's certainly not an image that we think of when we think of a creator God. You think about it for a second. What animal lives savagely the way Hobbes describes mankind without a guiding state? What animal lives that way? That's not a productive way for a species to behave. Species, and most specifically the human species, tend to cooperate so that they can make life easier. Now, let's step back just for a second. Something Peter says there in his statement, he refers to violent rituals, like mass human sacrifice to state gods. We think about some of the really powerful states of antiquity, and mass human sacrifice tended to be one of the characteristics of the state. So, Peter, is that what you're referring to? The state monopoly on violence and the tendency of the state to go towards mass human sacrifice, like what Hitler did, or like what Mao did, or what Stalin did, or like what Pol Pot did? Is that what you're talking about, Peter? Is that what the modern state has eliminated? Now let's reread just a little part here. He quotes this Harvard egghead, and he says that one of the main drivers behind less violent societies is the spread of the constitutional state and the introduction on a large scale of the state monopoly on legitimized use of violence, legitimized by a democratically elected government, legitimized by checks and balances and an independent judicial system. In other words, a state monopoly that has the use of violence well under control. Now, talk about being out of touch with reality. This is as silly as the nonsense Hobbes tried to feed us. Now, let's think about this just for a minute. He says an independent judicial system. Well, I could just start quoting Hans Hermann Hoppe on this one. But when you have the state as the sole arbitrator in all conflicts, including the conflicts that involve the state, how exactly is that independent? How do you have an independent judiciary when the state itself controls the judiciary, and the judiciary is the final arbitrator in all conflicts, including conflicts with the state? How is that in any way independent? That's like saying the military is independent of the state. How can you make this kind of leap? Is the presidency or is the prime minister independent of the state? That's a silly doublespeak meant only to confuse people as he walks around the stage with his rifle. Now, in addition to that, this whole idea that a democratically elected government somehow has the legitimized use of aggressive force. How is it that if three people vote over two other objectors, that the three people can rob the two? How does that in any way bring legitimacy to the robbery by the three of the two? Just because they voted on it? Is that somehow legit? Does democracy somehow have, it holds some magical characteristic that allows all morals to be set aside if we vote? If the majority decides it, then all of a sudden it's okay to use aggression and violence? That's what legitimizes it? Okay, so let's go back to quoting him again. He says, "Such a state monopoly on violence, first of all, serves as a reassurance. It removes the incentive for an arms race between potential hostile groups in our society. Secondly, the presence of penalties that outweigh the benefits of using violence tips the balance even further. Abstaining from violence becomes more profitable than starting a war. Now, nonviolence starts to work like a flywheel. It enhances peace even further. Where there is no conflict, trade flourishes. And trade is another important incentive against violence. With trade, there's mutual interdependence and mutual gain between parties. And when there's mutual gain, both sides stand to lose more than they would gain if they started a war. War is simply no longer the best option, and that's why violence has decreased." Wow. You know, that's like almost true, except it's not. There's so much revealed in this little paragraph. Let me just break it down a little bit for you. He says, "Such a state monopoly on violence, first of all, serves as a reassurance. It removes the incentives for an arms race, between potentially hostile groups in our societies." Let's see, like, for example, the democratically elected governments of Israel and Iran, or perhaps the democratically elected governments of Pakistan and India. There's two examples right off the top of my head where two democratically elected governments are right on the verge of war and have been for a long time with each other, and another two democratically elected governments right on the verge of war with each other, and three of the four that I just named have nuclear capabilities, and the fourth is, we are told, I don't believe it, but we're told that they're trying desperately to get nuclear capability. And so how is it that even though we look right at the evidence, you still want to tell us there's no arms race because they're democratically elected? So then, what kind of a state could have a monopoly on violence without an arms race? The only way is if there's only one state. But let's not go there for right now. I'll come back to that. He says, secondly, the presence of penalties that outweigh the benefits of using violence tips the balance even further. Really? The presence of penalties that outweigh the benefits of using violence tip the balance even further. He says, abstaining from violence becomes more profitable than starting a war. Wow! All of a sudden, states care about profit. states who create nothing and obtain all of their funding through theft suddenly will care about profit. Amazing. It's like magic. He's taking a principle from human action, straight out of Mises' book, and he's perverting it to apply it to the state, like the state could ever act like a human. Now, let me point out something, a difference between the state and an individual human. An individual inherits certain traits within their characteristics of their being, and they learn certain things from their parents, and they learn as they grow and as they mature, they learn through the reward and punishment process that we face every day in life. And this is the pressures of the market, rewarding good behavior and punishing bad behavior. This is assuming no state to interfere. But states don't act. States are not human. States cannot act. Only humans can act. Now, the state takes away the consequences of individual actions of individual humans. Therefore, the state's very existence increases the chances of violence. Okay, now let's go on. We're running out of time really quick here. He says, now nonviolence starts to work like a flywheel and enhances peace even further. And I have an arrow at this in my notes with the letters LOL written next to it. Then he goes on to say, oh, I see. A nonviolence, as he describes it. Now, nonviolence, what he's calling nonviolence, this includes the state monopoly on violence. So suddenly it's not violence if the state does it. If it's state-sanctioned, it's not violence. It's okay. So then, yeah, if we don't count the state aggression, if we don't count state violence, then right in the middle of Dresden, while it was burning and bombs were blowing up, that was totally peaceful right there. And right at ground zero at Nagasaki at minute zero, and right there at that moment when the flash took place and all those bodies turned into ash, it was really, really peaceful right there. Then he goes on to say, it's in that same section. He says, where there is no conflict, trade flourishes. Now, that almost sounds right, except that's just the opposite. You see, where there is free trade and no state monopoly of violence, or when there's no state monopoly of any kind, violence becomes unprofitable and conflicts can be settled privately. He says, and trade is another important incentive against violence. With trade, there's mutual interdependence and mutual gain between parties. And when there is mutual gain, both sides stand to lose more than they would gain if they started a war. Yeah, unless you have a group of massive corporations depending on that state monopoly of violence to perpetuate never-ending war for the purpose of increasing their war profiteering. So yeah, some of that makes sense, except there are massive corporations that use the force and the aggression of government in order to keep war going so they can make more money. So your entire thing falls apart simply because you have the state there with a monopoly of violence. He says, war is simply no longer the best option. And that's why violence has decreased. All right, now remember, he's already redefined violence to exclude state violence. So that's like, let's say you're standing on a street corner and a guy walks up to you and punches you right square in the nose. And let's say there's another guy that's standing there with a clipboard doing a survey. And he says, so has violence increased or decreased since you've been standing here? And you're holding your bleeding nose and you're like, well, I think violence has increased. And he says, no, not counting that guy. And about that time, that guy pops you in the nose again. And you're like, dude, he's hitting me in the nose right now. I think violence is increasing. And the questioner is like, no, we're not going to count that guy in this question. But what do you think? Has violence increased or decreased? You see how ridiculous this is? Okay, let's go back to quoting him again. He says, this, ladies and gentlemen, is the rationale behind the existence of my armed forces. The armed forces implement the state monopoly on violence. We do this in a legitimized way only after our democracy has asked us to do so. Huh. I don't remember voting on war. It is this legitimate, controlled use of the gun that has contributed greatly to the statistics of war. conflict and violence around the globe. It is this participation in peacekeeping missions that has led to the resolution of many civil wars. My soldiers use the gun as an instrument of peace. I noticed this part. He says, the armed forces implement this state monopoly on violence. The armed forces implement the state monopoly on violence. Upon whom do the armed forces implement this monopoly? Is it the citizenry? Is he saying that it's the legitimate use of the military and specifically NATO forces on the citizenry? Is that what he's saying? Because that could explain his earlier statements about ending the occurrences of civil war. It's easy to implement a monopoly on violence if you're the only ones with the guns, see? So then, if we're to believe that it's not on the citizenry that he's talking about, then who's left? Well, government against government, as we have seen until all governments are under one united global state. This can be the only logical conclusion to this theory of the legitimate use of the armed forces to implement the state monopoly on violence. It has to boil down to one state, perhaps numerous governments, but all subservient to that one state. And then we have this, he says, my soldiers use the gun as an instrument of peace. Now, how wonderfully Orwellian is that? War is peace and obedience is freedom. Okay, let's go back to quoting him, and I'll try to hurry this up because we're about to run out of time. And this is him again. And this is exactly why failed states are so dangerous. Failed states have no legitimized, democratically controlled use of force. Failed states do not know of the gun as an instrument of peace. Failed states do not know of the gun as an instrument of peace and stability. That is why failed states can drag down a whole region into chaos and conflict. That is why spreading the concept of the constitutional state is such an important aspect of our foreign missions. That is why we are trying to build a judicial system right now in Afghanistan. Side note. There was already a judicial system in Afghanistan. Back to his quote again. That is why we've trained police officers, we train judges, we train public prosecutors around the world. And this is why, and in the Netherlands, we are very unique in that. That is why the Dutch Constitution states that one of the main tasks of the armed forces is to uphold and promote the international rule of law. You see, oh, that's the end of the quote, by the way. Once you begin using aggression to obtain your desires, and then you begin redefining your words to mean whatever you want them to mean, it's not hard to fancy yourself as the judge of all things you survey. So who decides which states are failed states? And what criteria is used? Once you've given one group this godlike power to say which states are legitimate and which are not, have you not guaranteed that that group will be the only legitimate state? And have you not legitimized the use of aggression against all who refuse that group? Isn't that really what you've done when you do that? Now let me go back to his quote again. He says, ladies and gentlemen, look at this gun. We are confronted with the ugly side of the human mind. Every day I hope that politicians and diplomats, development workers, can turn conflict into peace and threat into hope. And I hope that one day armies can be disbanded and humans will find a way of living together without violence and oppression. But until that day comes, we will have to make ideals and human failures meet somewhere in the middle. Until that day comes, I stand for my father, who tried to shoot the Nazis with his old gun. I stand with my men and women who are prepared to risk their lives for a less violent world for all of us. Remember how he defines violence. Back to the quote. I stand for this soldier who suffered partial hearing loss and sustained permanent injury to her leg, which was hit by a rocket on a mission in Afghanistan. Now, this section does two things. First off, it tugs at your heartstrings for sympathy and support, and then it quietly promises that some sweet day Once we implement the state's monopoly of violence enough, once we blow up enough stuff and crack enough heads, you can totally trust us to be nice then. Let's go back to quoting him again. Ladies and gentlemen, until the day comes when we can do away with guns, I hope we all agree that peace and stability do not come free of charge. It takes hard work, often behind the scenes. It takes good equipment and well-trained, dedicated soldiers. I hope you will support the efforts of our armed forces to train soldiers like this young captain and provide her with a good gun instead of the bad gun my father was given. I hope you will support our soldiers when they're out there, when they come home, and when they're injured and need our care. They put their lives on the line for us, for you, and we cannot let them down. Again, this is just tugging at, it's the same two things. It's tugging at your heartstrings for sympathy and support, yet it's quietly promising that eventually peace will come through enough implementation of aggression. If you do bad long enough, good will somehow happen. If two wrongs can't make a right, keep doing wrong until it makes right. That's the logic that we're being given here. Okay, let's get back to the end now. Back to quoting him. And this is his final. He says, I hope you will respect my soldiers, this soldier with this gun, because she wants a better world, because she makes an active contribution to the better world, just like all of us here today. Thank you very much. And that's the end of his quote. And again, I want to emphasize, I believe this guy and the soldier on stage with him are absolutely 100% sincere and absolutely 100% deluded. Let's go back to Hans Senholz. Okay, here we go. War cannot be driven out by war, for the use of evil breeds more evil, hostility, more hostility, and the use of force, more force. Now let's just think of it this way for a moment. Let's say we have a village, and let's say it's in some backward country, or what we consider to be a backward country. And in this village, a bad man comes into town. Somebody who the town is not strong enough to repel, but perhaps he has some relatives in that town or some connection to that town. So now the town is not strong enough to repel him. So there's very little they can do about him being there. So while he's there, he's visiting some type of public activity, and a drone comes in, fires a Hellfire missile and kills him, along with 20 or 30 people that happen to be in the same location at the same time. Now, the harsh, cold way of looking at this is to say, well, they shouldn't have been near that terrorist, that bad guy, that guy that's on our list. Well, yeah, you might think that, except here's the problem. In that little village where one bad guy was killed, or maybe one or two bad guys were killed along with him, maybe a handful, maybe he had a dozen guys with him, but one way or the other, it was not the village that was the problem. It was the bad guy and his personal guard or whatever was with him. But that missile didn't know who it was hitting. That missile coming from a drone didn't know who it was hitting. So as it takes out children that happen to be in the wrong place at the wrong time, and perhaps a newlywed couple that was just there, getting married and looking at a new future for themselves, and that's snuffed out so that a U.S. Politician can scrape another name off of a list and pat himself on the back, or so that that guy in the Netherlands can say, well, we're enforcing the monopoly of violence, the state monopoly of violence. But what have you done in that village? The village who didn't really appreciate that bad guy being there to begin with, you've now murdered innocent people to get that one guy. You have committed evil with the hope that doing evil will somehow make good. And I might add, to kill someone with a Hellfire missile shot from a drone is not only evil, it's also lazy, and it's rude. You think about a way of fighting where a warrior faces a warrior. This is has a, even if you're anti-war, a warrior facing another warrior has a level of nobility. It has honor. And once they face each other, they have the choice of if they commit combat or if they can negotiate or whatever needs to take place. But when some CIA, pimple-faced geek, sitting in some office somewhere, in a mock-up like a video game, flies a brainless drone over an area where he's never been and knows nothing about the terrain, knows nothing about the culture or the people, and he's just following an order, and he presses a button, and a major section of a village dies to get one or two or five or ten guys. That's really, really evil. And it's also entirely lacking honor. And it's also very cowardice. And that's modern warfare. In the last century, a plane would fly over way up in the sky, and a bomb bay door opened, and buttons were pushed, and a city evaporated. That was bad enough. This is worse. For more on liberty, the zero aggression principle, and property rights, go to badquaker.com. Thank you.